Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
My Sporting Life. Paul Coit in conversation with Les Ferdinand on Talk Sports.
Today, one of this country's most lethal goal scorers. He was born in West London on the 8th of December 1966 and spent his early career playing non-league football until he moved to Queen's Park Rangers at the age of 20. The next year, he was loaned to Beşiktaş in Turkey for a season before making his name back at Queen's Park Rangers. In 1995, he was sold to Newcastle for what was his most successful time, scoring 29 goals and nearly winning the Premier League title under Kevin Keegan. He signed for his boyhood team Spurs in 1997, winning the League Cup in 1999, and played at West Ham, Leicester, Bolton and Reading before finishing at Watford in 2006. Capped 17 times by England, PFA Player of the Year 1996, and now Director of Football at Queen's Park Rangers, Sir Les Ferdinand. How are you, Les?
I'm good, Paul. Nice to be here with you.
It's really good to see you as well. You know, I say, if you ever got a knighthood, would you be Sir Les? I think that's probably how it was. You've been asked this a billion times. Where did it come from? Because everybody calls you Sir Les.
I know, it started at Queen's Park Rangers, and I don't think it was supposed to be Sir, but someone picked it up in the papers as Sir Les.
Yeah.
I think that the QPR supporters used to chant something else, and something came up as Sir Les.
Right.
And it started from there. And to be honest, I went to Turkey, and they used to call me Sir Les out there.
Oh,
and,
did they?
Yeah, they sort of like did loads of pictures of me with the English gentleman suit on and all that, and the morning suit thing, and always used to call me Sir out there. And then I moved to Newcastle, came back to QPR, went to Newcastle, and like you said, everywhere I've been called Sir Les.
I love it though. Don't
been
you?
Called a lot worse as well. By the way,
I can imagine. Actually, I can't imagine. Of course, I can't. Now from the years that I've known you, and every time that I've met you, and I'm not blowing smoke at all, but you always appear completely unaffected and very straight down the middle and just like a regular guy. And I'd be interested to know, what is this down to? Is it down to the fact of your upbringing, or is it because you had to pay your dues on the way up playing football? You weren't given it on a plate. Is that what it is?
I think it's a bit of both, really.
Yeah.
And I'd probably have to give my family most of the credit because they kept my feet firmly on the ground. It didn't matter what I did, what I achieved, I was still less to them.
Yeah.
I'd put it down to my upbringing. And like you said, you know, I used to work for a living. I used to drive a van. I used to do painting and decorating. I did steam cleaning. I did lots of different things before. I was fortunate to make it as a professional footballer.
So all the way through, and obviously we're going to go through, is that always there? Was it always there at the back of the mind? Did you always remember this is where I came from?
Yeah, it always has been. Yeah. You know, I've been very, very fortunate to play the game that I've loved and enjoyed. But I don't see myself, you know, my granddad gave me some really good values, and my dad and my mum as well. And, you know, they always used to say to me, my granddad always used to say to me, like, there's no one out there that's better than you.
Yeah.
But there's no one that you're better than either. So treat people with respect if they treat you with respect. And that's how I've lived my life, really.
Good way of doing it. So how did football begin to you? Because, you know, you grew up in West London, but you're a Spurs fan, weren't you?
Yeah, it was kind of strange. Growing up in West London. Not far from where QPR was, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
So really, I should have been a QPR fan. And in fact, QPR was, as a kid, QPR was the only team I went to see live, because I had an uncle who was a QPR supporter, and he dragged me along there one day with me and my cousin to get us from under the feet of my mum and my aunties and stuff.
Gillard going right up on the goal line. It's already taken, though, as Bowles turns it in. Gillard with a header against the crossbar, yes! It's David Webb.
Yeah, QPR was the only team I went to see live. But
why? Why was it?
It's really strange because I think back in the day, my parents weren't into football.
Sure.
And the only thing they knew about football was what they read in the papers. Mm. And growing up in the 60s and 70s, football stadium wasn't a place for a young black boy to be.
Yeah.
And, you know, for safety reasons. So I was never allowed to go. My cousin was a massive Liverpool supporter.
Mm-hmm.
He used to have all the kits and stuff like that. And at the time I said, look, I'm not going to support anyone outside of London, although Liverpool were probably the Lammer club up in the north back then. And I said I had to support someone in London, and suppose Spurs were the glamour club in London
yeah.
at the time.
Yeah.
So that's how I ended up an armchair Spurs supporter.
It's funny, I'm the same age as you, and it was where I grew up, which was on the other side of London. It was either Spurs, West Ham, but Liverpool, because there was always the glory hunters, wasn't there?
Exactly.
They're still around today. So tell me about Southall and Hayes then, and when you started beginning to think, you know, or did you think, hold on, there could be a career in this for me? Or was it just, I just love playing football?
The thing is, I never ever thought I was going to be a professional footballer. And it's the same advice I hand out to my kids, or have done in the past, in that I played football because I loved it.
Yeah.
So, you know, when I played for South or when I played for Hayes, it was all about being able to go and train Tuesdays and Thursdays and play on a Saturday.
Mm.
And I did that because I loved it. And when I started off, I started off with a load of mates from school. There was about eight of us that went to Southall. And it kind of like wilted down till it was, you know, I was the only one out of our year group that carried on going.
Did you know you were good?
Yeah, I knew I was a decent player.
Yeah.
Because I went to Southall, I was playing. I played in the youth team, worked my way up. And, you know, before I was 17, I was playing in the first team. So I must have been okay. I got kicked about a little bit because I was younger.
Yeah.
But it kind of like made me a little bit robust, and I got used to men's football quite quickly.
So when did Queen's Park Rangers come knocking then, and how did that happen?
So basically what happened was I was at Southall. We got to the final, and then after the final, the team disbanded.
Right.
We lost the final 3-1, and the team disbanded, and we was kind of like scratching my head thinking about what am I going to do next. And along the way, the manager at Southall at the time, a fella called Gordon Bartlett, had seen my dad a couple of times and said, you know, your son's got good ability. If he'd really take football seriously. I thought I was taking it seriously.
Sure.
But he said, if your son took it seriously and knuckled down for a bit, I think he's got a good chance of turning pro.
Yeah.
And, you know, there'd been rumours in the past that, you know, professional clubs had looked at me and nothing could come of it. And I was sort of like, I was 18, I was you know, 17, 18. I was thinking, professional football's passed me by now, so what I'm going to do, I'm going to try to play to the highest level
yeah.
I can in non-league football. And always remember my dad saying to me, listen, why don't you knuckle down for a year? Just give it 1 year.
Mm.
And he said, knuckle down, do everything that you need to do in that 1 year. And if it don't work out, it don't work out. But at least you know you've given it your best shot.
He was a bit more interested in football by this point.
By this time, yeah, because I was... yeah. I was, and the thing is, he was only coming... He'd only ever come and see me play if I was in a cup final
yeah.
at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said, I've heard this on many occasions from different managers, even when I was playing five-a-side football, that your son's got good ability.
Mm.
So why don't you give it a shot at doing it properly? So I said, okay. Like I said, I thought I was doing it properly before that. But
what do I do now? What do I do more of?
So anyway, the team disbanded, and then I got a call from a fellow called George Goody, who was the manager of Hayes at the time.
Yeah,
and he said, "Look, we'd lost our centre forward, and you know, we've watched you play a few times. We'd love you to come in and do pre-season with us." So I did, and I thought, "This is it. I'm going to get my head down. I'm going to go and do pre-season properly." This was like two levels above where I was playing, and see how I go. I went there, did the pre-season, was in the side, started scoring goals from the off, and I was at Hayes for 6 months.
And were you thinking, I've gone up a level, but it fits? It doesn't feel any different. I can deal with this quite easily.
Yeah, I was still scoring goals like
yeah, yeah.
I had been at. I'd come off the back of a good goal scoring season at Southall when we got to the Vars final, and. I remember going to Hayes and thinking, right, this is two levels up from where I was. Let me see how I fit in.
Mm.
Just went in and started scoring goals there. And like I said, I was at Hayes for 6 months. I'd probably been at Southall for three and a half years. Went to Hayes for 6 months, and then QPR signed me. I'd signed a contract at Hayes as well. Never signed a contract at Southall, but signed a contract at Hayes. And I'd only been there for 6 months, and they got the rewards that perhaps Southall should have got a bit of.
They made a few quid, didn't you, over the years, yeah. Which is great. So Queen's Park Rangers, this were, I guess, Jim Smith was the manager, right?
Yeah, the late Jim Smith was the manager.
So Jim, a legendary name in football. So you've been there for a while. You'd played. What do you remember about the first game? Was it Southampton you played away? Wasn't that the game?
Yeah, that was just the first reserve game I played.
Yeah.
And I remember sort of like turning up at Loftus Road and thinking at the time, wow, I'm just about to go and play my first game. I was still working. I had to work my notice thing at work at the time. And I remember turning up for this game. And the first person to come out and greet me was Sammy Lee.
Yeah.
And he shook my hand. He said, welcome to QPR, young man. I wish you all the best for your career.
Yeah.
And I thought, and I just stood there in awe thinking, this is Sammy Lee.
It's the Liverpool Sammy. This is the guy. He looks just like him. He sounds like him.
Yeah. And we I remember getting on the coach. It was Gary Chivers, David Kerslake. There were a few players that I got on a coach with, and we went down to Southampton, and I played my first reserve game for QPR. And I always remember I played against Jimmy Case. Everyone had told me what a hard man Jimmy Case was, and you hear these rumours and you read magazines and stuff like that, and I always remember he whacked me. First 10, 15 minutes, ball came into me, didn't control it properly, he whacked me. I was laying on the floor, he stepped across me and he went, welcome to professional football, young man. I was just looking up at him thinking, all right, is it going to be like this thing?
Yeah, well, thanks to Jimmy Case, Les is baptised as a professional footballer, but it was nothing compared to what was awaiting him in Turkey, where he really grew up, playing on loan for a season at Besiktas, and the brand new Premier League begins. I'm Paul Coyte. When we return, with Les Ferdinand on My Sporting Life.
My Sporting Life. Paul Coyte in conversation with Les Ferdinand on Talk Sport.
It's 1988 and 21-year-old striker Les Ferdinand at Queen's Park Rangers, where manager Jim Smith decides that a loan move would be best for his development. But, Les, to Turkey and Besiktas, right?
Yeah, so Gordon Mill, the late Liverpool player, yep, and ex-Leicester manager, he'd gone out to the Besiktas in Turkey. And Gordon Mill, like I said, has spoken to Jim Smith, said, I'm looking for a centre-forward. And Jim Smith has said to him, look, we got this young player here. We think he could be anything, or he could be nothing.
Yeah.
But I think if he went to Turkey, this could either make him or it could break him. And I always remember having a conversation with Jim, and I was like, yeah, all right, yeah. And I thought I was just fobbing him off a little bit, saying, yeah. I'll think about it, thinking I'm never going to go to Turkey. And then Gordon Mill came over. And there was this, you know, as you do, managers sometimes have people come in and watch training and stuff. Yeah. And there was this guy on the sidelines watching training, dressed in kit, and was thinking, who's this fella? Mm. And then Jim Smith came to me afterwards and he said, look, you remember I was telling you about this, you know, the manager in Turkey, this is him, this is Gordon Mill. He wants to have a chat with you. So I sat down and had a chat with Gordon briefly at the training ground. And then I met him that evening in a hotel in Holland Park. And we sat there and he sold it to me. He said to me, look, I think this would be a great opportunity for you. The club have got high hopes. They think you can go on to be something, but they just think you need a bit of direction. And he said, coming out there, we'll do this. And I was like, okay, yeah, brilliant. And he really sold it to me. But even the day I left to go to Turkey, I remember coming out my front door, mum and dad with me, taking me to the airport. I got two suitcases in my hand and I'm thinking, where the hell am I going?
Yeah.
You know, the only thing I knew about Turkey at the time was the film Midnight Express.
That's not good.
Which is not the best advert in the world for Turkey.
He was a 20-year-old boy, up against a system he didn't understand, spoken in a language he couldn't speak. And yet, he triumphed. The movie is Midnight Express.
But I jumped on a plane and Gordon came with me and we landed in Istanbul. And I always remember coming out, jumping off the plane and walking down, you know, as you go down the gangway and you go into the area where you go to pick your luggage up. I saw, like, walking down there and it was like loads of photographers, like just taking pictures and clamouring around people. And I'm thinking, oh, Gordon's come back. And Gordon's got, like, pulled himself and taking pictures of me. And I'm thinking, geez, here's a kid, I've just come out of the reserves of QPR.
Yeah.
And the expectation of these people are ridiculous. Like, you know, when they're taking pictures of me, we was driving from the airport to a hotel. Because in Turkey, they don't have, like, you know, we use our stadiums as offices.
Yeah.
In Turkey, they don't do that. They have their offices in the middle of town. So I went to the offices and we're being followed by cars and the horns are going, people are tooting and they're cheering and everything. And I'm thinking, geez.
So are you thinking, this is either not for me or how can I live up to this? What am I going to do? Get me out of here now.
It was living up to this. I was thinking, how am I going to live up to this? Do they know I've just come out of the reserves? And anyway, we got to the hotel. We spent about a couple of hours and then Gordon said to me, look, I'm going to take you to the stadium. There's a little training session. What he said, I'm going to introduce you to all the players.
Yeah, nice. Yeah.
We're off to Germany. We were off to Germany the next day, pre-season. So he said to me, I'm going to take you, introduce you to the players. I thought, okay, yeah, brilliant. So anyway, had a little bit of a rest, got my boots, and we're heading to the stadium. So as we're driving, there were sort of like directors from the club that came with us.
Yeah.
And they said, all right, follow us. So we're following the cars and stuff like that. We get down. As we're getting closer to the stadium, I could hear this noise, like this boom, 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 thinking, okay. So we pull up, and obviously I don't know where the stadium is. I've never been there before. We pull up to this magnificent place, and all of a sudden, there's like thousands of people about. And I'm thinking, okay. Is there some market or something going on? Like, you know? Anyway, I go into the stadium and the change rooms were underground.
Yeah.
But they had the little windows that you could see the pitch. And I could just hear this carnival atmosphere going on. I said to Gordon, I thought you said, like, this is a training session to meet the lads. He goes, yeah, but what they do, they introduce all the players to the supporters at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, the new signings to the supporters. And like I said, I got to the stadium. It's 35,000 people
to watch the first day's
training.
First day's training, 35,000. But it worked out really well for you, didn't it? Because would you say that this was almost the apprenticeship, the making of you?
That's the one thing I do say to people. That was my footballing apprenticeship.
Ferdinand. Ferdinand. Ferdinand kaleci ile karşı karşıya vuruyor gol. Karşılaşmanın 15. dakikasında Ferdinand'ın tın attığı golle Beşiktaş Fenerbahçe karşısında 1-0 üstünlük sağlıyor.
I got away from London and one of the things I tried to do when I was here and I signed for QPR, I tried to remain the same person I was before, and I was still knocking around my mates. I didn't want my mates to think I was anything different.
Is that hard though, Les? Is it hard to do?
It is really hard, because everybody expects you to be different, but you try to stay the same.
Yeah.
So I wanted to do the same things I was doing with my mates before, and my life is very, very different.
Of course.
And so I had to kind of like change my mentality, change what I was doing. And I couldn't do that while I was in London.
Mm.
And I think it was the best thing that ever happened to me in terms of my footballing career. Going there taught me how to be a professional. And I don't talk about Gordon Mill enough because he was absolutely fantastic for me at that time. People always ask me who's the best manager I've ever worked with. And I say at different times, managers have come along in my career that have been absolutely ideal for me. And Gordon was absolutely perfect for me. It was just what I needed at that time. I went to Turkey and I had a whole year to concentrate on just football and nothing else.
Everything, you've got the crowds, you've got every experience. It's almost like this is set up for you to learn, I guess.
Yes.
So you win the Turkish Cup there, don't you? And then you come back to Queen's Park Rangers. You come back a different person and a different player, and I guess you would be a lot more confident in your own skin going out and playing football now in front of crowds and the professional game as well when you come back.
Yeah, I came back with a renewed sense of I can do this. And I suppose when I first got into professional football, I doubted myself because, you know, you're playing with all these guys that have had apprenticeships, who've come through the system and known football and understood football all their lives. And here I was trying to mingle in with these guys, and it took me a little while to settle and understand that I did belong.
Mm.
So going out to Turkey, like I said, was like my apprenticeship. I came back with a renewed confidence. And when I went onto the training pitch, it was really funny because I'd come back and we had the likes of Peter Reid was at QPR, Nigel Spackman, Ray. I don't think Ray was there yet.
Mm.
He was on his way. But I always remember Peter Reid. We did an 11v11, and Peter Reid said to me afterwards, I went, "Who's this kid? Where's he come from?"
Yeah, yeah.
And everyone said, "Oh, it's Les Ferdinand, and he's been out in Turkey on loan." I said, "Out on loan? If he's been out on loan, what have we got here?" Like, you know what I mean? So, I came back and I felt I belonged, and it still took me a little while to get into the side, but I came back realising that I could be the professional footballer I wanted to be.
Let's look at a few stats then, Les. 89-90, you played 9 games for QPR. 90-91, 18 games, scoring 8 goals. 91-92, 10 goals in 23 games. But the season 92-93, not only for you, but for football, was a brand new era.
The FA Premier League, live, only on scarf. It's a whole new ballgame.
Yeah, I think I'm the first year of the Premier League, and that's obviously because of the razzmatazz that came with the Premier League. Obviously, you had to score the goals, and I think I ended up with 20 goals or something, somewhere around that figure that season. And as you said there, because of the razzmatazz that came with the Premier League, it propelled you into everyone's thoughts and minds because people were now seeing you on a regular basis.
Scoring lots of goals, seen everywhere, and then obviously people are going to start talking, thinking, you know, he's done very well at Queen's Park Rangers. Because, I mean, you were the highest placed London side, weren't you, at the time? And then it's like, what's going to happen now? And was there much talk that was going on through your career before you did actually move away from Queen's Park Rangers? That you were going to go, were you looking for a move early on, or were you just happy with what you were doing?
I was never ever looking for a move. I was happy with what I was doing at QPR. I was enjoying my time. You know, I felt we had a really good side. And we did have a really good side. As you said, we were top lung club and we were doing well, but we was never going to win the league.
Yeah.
You know, we were going to have a good cup run. We might have got to an FA Cup final. I suppose that's what we were thinking at the time, but at the time we were just too small to be challenging those bigger teams in the division. So, but I felt I was always learning. You know, Jerry Francis came into to QPR. You know, Trevor Francis gave me my debut, and then Don Hire took over for a while. And me and Don probably had a bit of a clash of personalities at the time. We didn't see eye to eye.
Now, we're going to have to cope with that, whether we like it or not, because we don't want to lose the game, do we? And you don't want to lose a game when you go out.
But I respected him as a coach. I thought he was one of the best coaches I worked with.
Was it just a personality thing then?
Yeah, I think it was. I think Don saw me as a young kid out of a council estate that should be glad of what I had and where I was. But I always had an opinion, and I'd let him know my opinion.
Yeah.
And so I don't think he was too enamoured with that.
Yeah.
And so that kind of probably restricted my time playing under Don a little bit, because I always remember him saying that, you know, the club should sell me. The club should sell me to Millwall, because Paul Goddard was at Millwall and Paul Goddard was going to go the other way.
Right.
And but Millwall wanted a bit of money on top of Paul Goddard going the other way, and the club didn't want to pay that money, so I ended up staying. And I always remember the chairman of QPR, Richard Thompson, at the time. When I actually eventually left and went to Newcastle, he said, "Don Howe would have cost this club 5.7 something million pounds because you two had a clash of personalities," and it was detrimental to my career at the time. But I wasn't someone that couldn't say anything. If someone said something, I'd have to reply to it. Probably that's because I grew up on a council estate.
If ever you saw Don Howe years later, was it just a, "Hey, Don"?
Yeah, no.
And that was it?
No, do you know what? I had the utmost respect for Don as a coach. I thought he was a very, very good coach. He's probably one of the best coaches I worked with. I understand that sometimes you have clashes of personality, but it ain't about the individual. It's about the team, and it's about the team doing well.
Sure.
And although I felt he hindered my career a little bit, and I probably didn't play as much as I wanted to under Don, if I saw Don, I know he's passed now, but it was never a problem talking to him.
Well, the move did come, and I think we all know where you went next. Les Ferdinand heads northeast to Kevin Keegan's Newcastle United when we return on My Sporting Life.
My Sporting Life. Paul Coit in conversation with Les Ferdinand on Talk Sport.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort,
so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
My Sporting Life. Paul Coit in conversation with Les Ferdinand on Talk Sport.
In the first season of the Premier League, Les scored 16 goals from 36 games to help QPR finish ninth. And although other clubs were interested, he signed a new contract. In 1994-95, he scored 24 goals. But after 10 years at Loftus Road, Les, you decided to go somewhere where you are still a legend to this day. So how and why Newcastle United, Les? Because it's a long way from home, isn't it?
Yeah, it was a long way from home. And to be honest with you, people had sort of like, for a couple of years, had been rumours about me leaving QPR and moving on. I know Arsenal came knocking a few times. Richard Thompson, who was the chairman at the time, was an Arsenal fan. And he tried to push me that way, but because of my loyalties and everything else, I couldn't go across the border.
Is that right? Even with Spurs, even then, yeah. That's hilarious.
So, I sort of like got to a stage where I had an opportunity to go to United.
Yeah.
And that fell through based on the manager coming in, who was Ray Wilkins. I mean, Jerry Francis, and I've spoken to him on many occasions. It said to Richard Thompson, you sell Les, and then I've got to go. Mm. And that's what happened. Man United came in. Richard Thompson asked me, did I want to go? And I said, look, at the time, they're the best team in the land, yeah? So he said, okay, let me speak to Jerry. He told Jerry. Jerry resigned. And Richard Thompson said to me, I can't lose my manager and my star striker in the same week. Mm-hmm. So I said, okay, no problem. And then he said to me, but give me a few days on it. Gave him a few days, and he came back to me. He said, look, I've got some good news and some bad news. He said, what do you want first? I said, give me the good news. He said, the good news is I think I've persuaded Ray Wilkins to come back as manager, because Ray had left and gone to Crystal Palace as a player. He said, I think I've convinced Ray to come back as player manager for QPR. And he said, I think the supporters and everyone will be appeased by that. I said, brilliant, great. I said, I'd love to have Ray back here. I think he'd be brilliant for the club. He said, the bad news, do you want that? I said, yeah. He said, Ray says he's only coming back on the basis that we don't sell you.
Oh.
So that's what happened. I didn't go. And I'm saying to someone today, I still call him the late great Ray Wilkins, because he was brilliant for my career. He was brilliant for me, and I couldn't be mad at him about it. It's just life, and I view life as what's meant to be will be. But what had happened, we'd had a conversation, and he said, look, I know come the end of the season you're gonna leave this football club. He said, but let's just get on with doing what we need to do now, and let's have the conversation at the end of the season.
Yeah.
And always remember, at the end of the season we went on a tour to Barbados. We had a couple of games to play out there. And I remember me and him sitting under a palm tree, and it was like Robinson Crusoe and Man Friday. We're both leaning up against this palm tree and sitting down, and we've got a soft drink in our hands.
Of course.
And we just talked about what was going to be next. And he said, look, I know you're going to move on. He said, I think it's time for you to move on. I'm going to wish you all the best. And I said, what are you going to do now? And he said, well, we'll struggle, because I don't think we'll be able to replace your goals.
When you know that everybody wants you and you're trying to work out where you're going to go, well, what are you feeling like at this point?
Yeah, it was exciting, because I didn't know where I was going to go.
Yeah.
But I knew there was a few clubs that were interested, and you know, it was about what was the right move, the best move, and the one that was going to advance my career. I felt I'd learnt at QPR under Jerry Francis all the time that he was here. And I said, the only time I'd leave QPR was when I felt I hadn't progressed and I hadn't learnt anymore. And I suppose I'd come to that time in my career there. And I always remember going to talk to Villa, who'd bid the asking price of, like, I think it was 6 million at the time. And I remember on the way there, get a call from Kevin Keegan saying that we've bid 6 million as well.
Hold on, does your phone ring? And then it's Kevin Keegan on the other end.
I had an agent at the time, and his phone rang and said, like, would Les do us the before he makes a decision about Villa, will he do us the honour of coming and speaking to me? And I said, yeah, of course I would. I went in and spoke to Doug Ellis, and he was brilliant with me. He sold Villa so well to me. But at the time, in that stage of my career, and where Aston Villa was and where QPR were, QPR had finished above Villa in the last couple of seasons, and I felt it was a sideways step rather than a forward step for me. And I went down the motorway, went back towards London, and Kevin Keegan met me in a hotel with my agent, and he spoke for about 10 minutes, and after the 10 minutes I was like, this is where I'm going. You know, at the time I think Newcastle was everyone's second favourite team with the stuff that it did, the way they got promoted and the football that they'd played in the Premier League. Up until then, I thought to myself, if there was anywhere I was going to go and progress my career, that was it. You know, they was on the up. And to be honest with you, when I got to the club, it was everything I wanted it to be, and even more in probably the first 6 months I was there.
So the team, though, and let's talk about 95, and it's the story that everybody knows, and the old 12. I mean, how many times you hear this a day? 12 points clear and a game in hand, and it was, you were on fire, and everything seemed to be working. So let's talk about those first few months before we move on to the second half of the season. Mm-hmm. Everything was perfect, wasn't it?
It was, like I said, I couldn't ask for more. I scored on my debut up at St James's Park. We beat Coventry 3-1. I scored the final goal.
And Ferdinand's off on a major run here. Ferdinand, he's round the keeper. Ferdinand, what a tremendous goal for Les Ferdinand, who opens his account, and St James's Park erupts. And Les says it in style.
And I'd always known that the number 9 was a special shirt up at Newcastle and what it meant to the supporters. But when I scored that goal, it was then all of a sudden I went, wow. Because it was like the roof came off the stadium, the fact that their number 9 had scored on the opening day of the season. And I remember going to Bolton in the next game, and I scored a headed goal. You know, my first goal was a headed goal. And one of the reporters came to me afterwards and he went, oh, this is going to be a season for us. He said, we didn't score because Newcastle used to play this lovely, you know, George Graham used to call it tippy-tappy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They used to play this tippy-tappy football that was lovely to watch. And I always remember one of the journalists saying to me, we didn't score our first headed goal till the end of November last year. And so he goes, and you've just scored that one on the opening day, opening week of the season. So we're excited about what's to come.
Yeah.
And like I said, the supply line from Keith Gillespie and David Ginola was just, you know, sensational.
Gillespie supporting. And Ginola again. Ginola with a cross.
I think I scored 13 goals in my first 12 goals at the first 12 games there. And I went on to set a new record, goal scoring record, in eight consecutive games and stuff like that. It was everything I dreamed about and more, to be honest, in that first 6 months.
In the Sports Centre, Jeff Stelling and Jane Hoffman.
Very good evening to you. Welcome to Sky Sports Centre on a busy night of Premiership action. 7 matches tonight. The big question, can anyone catch Newcastle United?
Well, of course, we all know the answer to that now. But by the 20th of January, you were 12 points clear. Top of the Premier League. What went wrong? Was it overconfidence?
I think it could have been a little bit of that. It could have been the fact that we... too many players lost form at the same time. And I think I don't want to say it was arrogance. It might have been a little bit of overconfidence. I think at the time, I think David Ginola had won the league at Marseille.
Mm-hmm.
Peter Beardsley had won some honours with Liverpool. Other than that, I don't think there was a player in our squad that had ever won anything.
Do you need that then, do you think?
What I think you need is a mentality. And we didn't have that because I think we were 12 points clear with a game in hand. And when we lost that first game that brought us down to 9 points clear, there wasn't a mentality of, oh, we've just lost 3 points there. The mentality was, oh no, when we win our game in hand, we'll be 12 points clear again. And someone had done the calculations, I think, if I'm not mistaken, Peter Beardsley had done the calculations. And if we'd have carried on winning in the way that we were, we'd have had the league wrapped up by the end of March. And there was all these little signs. I remember going away to coming back from London I'd been down to see my family for Christmas and came back after a couple of days after, and when I walked into the training ground, there was a geezer walking with a shirt on saying Champions 96. And I thought,
oh, no.
You know, just these little things that you don't want to see. And I'm thinking, the supporters are overconfident. We were overconfident. And it was no holding back, you know what I mean? It was like, no, let's calm down a little bit. Everyone was like, no, this is what we're going for. And I just think at the time we just, we lost our way, and we lost that 9 points became 3 points very, very quickly, because we lost 1, 2, 3 games in a week. And before you knew it, we was, Man United had just overtaken us.
So the 3 points clear in April, and they managed to squeeze past 10-man Leeds United 1-0 Old Trafford. And after the game, Alex Ferguson said this.
For some of them, it's more important to get a result against Manchester United to stop winning the week than anything else. And of course, when they come to Newcastle, you wait to see the difference.
And then when you beat Leeds 1-0, we all remember what Kevin Keegan had to say.
You can tell him now, if you're watching it, we're still fighting for this title, and he's got to go to Middlesbrough and get something. And I'll tell you, honestly, I will love it if we beat them. Love it.
Where were you when he was saying that?
We were sat on the coach, and technology wasn't as good as it is nowadays, and so we couldn't see the manager's interview. We knew that he was in there doing the interview, but we couldn't see it because we couldn't get it on the coach at the time. And it wasn't until we actually got back home and I watched a rerun of the game, because I was one of those, after a game, a night game, I struggled to sleep after it. I was all adrenaline was still pumping through my body. So I was sitting there, so I put the game on. The game was on and was watching a rerun. And it was only at the end of the rerun that I saw the rant.
Did he not get on the coach and say, you know, I've had a bit of a go? So nobody knew a thing?
Not a thing.
Right.
No one knew a thing.
So
until,
what did you think when you saw it?
So when I saw it, you know, when I was, you know, people always laugh and they say that it was when, you know, Keegan lost it, you know, he lost the mind games with Ferguson. I always say, at the time, everyone that supports a football club wants their players to wear their heart on their sleeve and give everything for that football club.
True.
Kevin Keegan as a manager wore his heart on his sleeve, and he couldn't have been any different. And he gave everything he could to that football club. And that was part of him giving everything he could to that football club. So they weren't a play. Yeah, of course, we went in the next day and we laughed and joked. We were all saying we'd love it, whatever, whenever we could. But I don't think there was any player in the team at that time that thought Kevin Keegan lost it.
So it didn't work out the way you wanted. Of course, it ended up second that year. But you were PFA Player of the Year.
Which was no consolation.
No.
Really, it was no consolation, because I went there and the whole point of me going to Newcastle and us getting that team together was about you know, us trying to win the title. We had a good go at it, and we just fell at the last hurdle. And you know, that's because the way we played. You know, we was all out of attack. We were going to score one more goal than you, and that doesn't always happen. And any team that wins the Premier League, they win games 1-0. You know, they win games 2-1. We were just so wide open. It was, you know, and I feel for our defenders now, because probably Darren Peacock was probably defender of the season, but he had to be, because he was throwing himself all over the place. You know, Philippe Albert, who was the goal scoring sort of like centre back, would bomb forward as well and leave Darren and Steve Harry on their own at times. So,
well, what entertainment, Les. It was great entertainment.
Still to come, Les is the PFA Player of the Year but doesn't get to play at Euro 96. Alan Shearer joins Newcastle, and Les heads back to London when we return on My Sporting Life.
My Sporting Life. Paul Coit in conversation with Les Ferdinand on Talk Sport.
It's the summer of 1996, and Les has ended his first season at Newcastle United as Premier League runner-up, as PFA Player of the Year, and 29 goals under his belt. But as the biggest home tournament since 1966 arrives, although you're in the England squad, Les, for Euro 96, you don't play.
Yeah, I think, and I always said that, I don't think that happens anywhere else, where, you know, you're PFA Player of the Year and you don't get to play a minute in your country's tournament. We've seen in the past where the centre-forwards who've had a great season and wasn't even part of the build-up to a tournament, but they've had such a good season that the manager puts them in and they end up being the stars of the tournament. And I'd sort of like... although we'd lost the league that year, I was still on fire and I was feeling like, yeah, I could, I could, that I was still felt pretty invincible and that I could go out and I could score goals. And then to go to the tournament, and I think, you know, Terry Venables made it pretty plain, pretty clear from the off that, you know, his preferred partnership was Teddy and Alan, and I kind of like knew that, but I thought I would definitely get some game time.
Yeah.
And to not get some game time at that period, it still baffles me.
The way I look at it and when I remember it, and I still think of Jimmy Greaves in the World Cup final, and Jimmy was on fire, and obviously it was different circumstances, but how he felt, and it did affect him for the rest of his life without any doubt. I mean, this is a World Cup win. This was Euro 96, but was it difficult to shake off? Because is it something you carried along for quite some time? Because the whole atmosphere in the country, everybody's loving it, but surely there's part of you that's thinking, you know what, I'm not getting to play, and this is really... I'm not feeling it the way everybody else is.
Yeah, and I mean, sort of like it was one of those tournaments that galvanised the whole country. It was the first time I'd seen sort of like women coming from the office and going to watch England games. Mm. And I'm not saying that women didn't watch England games before,
but anybody in that situation wouldn't like football. Yeah.
And I think the country was in the doldrums, and Euro 6 kind of like galvanised the whole country, and everyone got behind it. You know, and it was a great time to be involved in football. But from a personal point of view, I remember the tournament finishing, and they wanted to have a dinner, and you know, all the boys went back to the hotel and to stay the night. And I wanted to get out of there. I just packed my stuff and I got out of there. And then we got invited to the Palace. All the players got invited to the Palace, and I didn't turn up because I just didn't feel part. I didn't feel part of it, and I didn't go.
The dream is over for England and for Terry Venables on a penalty shootout, and it's Germany who meet the Czech Republic in the final here on Sunday.
So it's time for a holiday, then back to St James's Park for the 96-97 season, and you've got a new partner.
20,000 Newcastle United fans forgot the rain today and set their sights on a brighter future. They turned up to welcome Alan Shearer back to his native North East after his record-breaking £15 million move from Blackburn.
So when you heard Shearer was coming in, were you happy about it? Or did you feel compromised and you're thinking, yeah, he's going to come in and he's going to steal my thunder?
Not at all. Keegan pulled me and he said to me, look, I'm not trying to prove anyone wrong here. He said, but I honestly believe that you and Alan will make a formidable partnership. And he said, what's going to happen is I'm going to sign Alan, and a load of the press people are going to say, because there's a certain manager in this country that doesn't think you two can play together, they're going to make up stories and say, like, you can't play together. But I honestly believe that you guys can form a good partnership. He said, so don't listen to anything you hear. You're staying here at Newcastle. I went, brilliant. He said, there's only one thing. I said, what's that? He said, he's asked for the number 9 shirt. I went, and what did you say? And he went, well, I said I'd ask Les, because he said, look, Alan's worn number 9 all his life. I said, well, so have I.
Yeah, yeah.
And he went, oh, I didn't realise that. I said, but you realised Alan did. And so all this time I'm thinking, I'm saying, Paul, this is a Geordie boy coming back to his home club.
Did it bother you, though?
Did it bother me?
Yeah, really.
My relationship was never the same with Kevin Keegan, because one year you're saying to me, I'm the best striker in the league.
Yeah.
And then the next year you're coming and asking for the most iconic shirt at this football club. So then now I stop believing in what you're saying.
Mm.
Yeah, so it did change our relationship. Was I bothered by it? I mean, it was really funny because we was on a trip to the Far East for pre-season. And when we landed, so none of the boys had known we'd signed Alan until we landed. And then obviously there was this world record fee and Alan's parading the number 9 shirt. So all the boys have gone, what's going on here? And I've gone, yeah, Les, what's going on? I said, like, yeah, Alan asked for the number 9. And then someone, did you sell it to him?
you probably could have done.
I could have done. They said, did you sell it? I went, no. And then it was all the lads were going, well, you better not take my number. And I was like, chaps, I ain't going to take anybody's number. And I always remember, I went to Tomo, who was the kit man at Newcastle, and he still is today. And I said to him, what numbers have you got available? And I think he said 16. He said 17 and he said 23. A big Michael Jordan fan growing up. Yeah. So I went, boom, done. I'm 23. So I went back to him and said, Tom, that's it, me, done, 23. So then anyway, Kevin Keegan pulls me and he says, look, the board have come on and they said they want you to have a number between 1 and 11. I said, tell the board I did have a number between 1 and 11 and they decided to take it off of me.
Yeah.
So don't now come and tell me I got to have a number between 1 and 11. And then he said to me, look, Lee Clark is leaving, and it looks like Lee Clark is going to Sunderland, so the number 10's available. And I went, I am not taking Clarkie's shirt, because myself and Clarkie lived in the same building. We was on the top floor, he lived on one side, I lived on the other. And him and Steve Watson were the guys that looked after me when I went to Newcastle and took me around, showed me the ropes. I thought, there's no way I'm taking his shirt. And then Keegan said he was leaving, and he didn't leave at the time, not straight away anyway. So we didn't speak getting into the lift for a couple of weeks because I had the number 10 shirt, but he was all right after that.
Ferdinand wins it. Simple as that.
Well, the Shearer-Ferdinand partnership was formidable that season. 49 goals between them, but Kevin Keegan left, Kenny Dalglish took over, and the club finished second again in the Premier League. But it was your last season, Les, on Tyneside. Did you regret leaving Newcastle when you did?
Yeah, I mean, I said, and I've always said it, and I never go back against it, you know. I went to play for my boyhood club, the team I supported as a boy, and I was an armchair supporter. But I made a decision out of pride rather than what was the right thing for my footballing career at the time. You know, Newcastle had agreed to sell me to Spurs. And I remember going down and speaking to Alan Sugar at the time, and Alan Sugar's vision for Spurs is probably what Spurs is today.
Mm.
You know, and for me, he was the one who started off where Spurs are today and where he wanted to take it. And I remember going and speaking, and unfortunately, the day I went down to speak, I went down on the Friday, did my medical. Alan broke his ankle on the Saturday, and then Newcastle tried to renege on the deal, but they couldn't because they'd already accepted the bid. But they came down and they spoke to my agent. They were allowed to speak to the agent, but they weren't allowed to speak to me.
Mm.
And they said, "Look, we want him to come back. We want to do this, and this." And I remember speaking to Alan. After he'd had his operation, I spoke to him, gave him a call, said to see how he's doing, and he said to me, "Are you coming back?" And I said, "No, mate, I don't think I am." And he went to me, "I got to be honest, I probably wouldn't if I was in your shoes." He said, "I'd love to have you back. I'd want to play with you more, but because of the way you've been treated," he said, I probably have made the same decision. And I always say to people, and I always say to my kids, never make a decision out of pride, because pride stops you from achieving what you want to achieve or going where you want to go. And I probably made a decision out of pride rather than what was the best thing for my footballing career at the time.
So you think now, looking back, you should have...
Yeah, and I thought that when I came to Spurs, and, you know, listen, I loved everything about being at Spurs, but in terms of I'd gone, I think, five seasons scoring 20-odd goals, went to Spurs, and it just all went pear-shaped.
Mm.
And I'd seen one of the Spurs players out. I was, again, in a coffee shop at about 2 o'clock in the morning.
I love those coffee shops, those late night coffee shops. Yeah.
And I remember him saying to me at the time, he said, "Look, we ain't the club you think it is." And kind of like I went there, and I went there based on what Alan Sugar was telling me and his visions for where he wanted to take Spurs, and I thought he was great. I really do. And like I said, in terms of what he was trying to do to the club and where he wanted to take it, I loved everything about it, but we was a struggling team. You know, I went there after a few months, Jerry Francis packed in. Then Christian Gross came in as manager. He was here for just over a year. George Graham came in.
Mm.
So in my first 5 years, I had four different managers and in the fifth year, I had a change of board. So it was like, that kind of tells you the type of turmoil that Tottenham were in at the time.
Sure. World, you know, won the Crooks League Cup final, Worthington, as it was then.
Right.
In 99, then time to leave West Ham, which is a bit of a strange move. I'm sure they loved you, didn't they? Did they see you as a Spurs player going straight to West Ham?
It was kind of a strange move for me at the time, because I'd always seen sort of like the Arsenal and Tottenham as the biggest rivals. But then when I went to West Ham, I realised how much West Ham didn't like Tottenham, to be fair.
Yeah, yeah. We all knew. You weren't aware. And then we'll wrap up the career, because we're looking at age 37. You go to Leicester, you're player of the season. You're still scoring goals, Bolton under Sam Allardyce. Is there a point, though, Les, where although your mind is saying, "Look, I can do this," there's probably part of you that's thinking, "There's stuff that maybe I can't do that maybe I used to." This must be the most difficult time for any player or any professional in any sport to know maybe my career's coming to an end.
Well, what happened was at 37, I sort of like, I still felt quite fit.
Mm.
And I went to Leicester. I'd left Tottenham and had 4 or 5 months at West Ham.
Yep.
Came to the end, and unfortunately, Glenn Rhoda at the time had a brain aneurysm. Yes. Yeah. And he wasn't in charge anymore, and they were saying, look, we need to wait for the next managers to come in. And in the meantime, Leicester, Southampton, I had a few clubs come in saying to me, look, we want to take you for next season. I was like, you know, West Ham had got relegated. I went, I didn't want to go out on a relegation if it was possible. So I had to play for another year.
Mm.
Mickey Adams persuaded me to go to Leicester. It was a toss-up between Leicester and Southampton. And I kind of like what Mickey had to say, I like what they were doing. And as you said, I went there and I was top goal scorer. I was players' player of the year. I was supporters' player of the year.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, okay, but we still got relegated. So do I finish here? And then I got a call from Sam Allardyce, who said he could have a chat with you. And I was like, Sam, no, I think I'm done now, mate. And he was going, no, please, before you make that decision, can we have a chat? And I said, okay. So I went to meet him. And he sat down and he had all this information. And at the time, Bolton were probably the most advanced football club I'd been to in terms of the way that they fought and data and everything else. Right. Sam was up there. And he showed me all my figures for the games that I played, the goals that I scored, and my high-intensity runs and blah, blah, blah. And he went to me, you've got too much to offer football.
Mm.
I said, my body's not telling me that, Sam. I said, when I wake up in the mornings, I feel like, you know, my missus used to say to me all the time, she used to say, Les, please retire. And I saw, I used to have a little step on, you know, get off the bed, and I used to have a step that I used to go
That's
down.
Amazing.
And I used to come off the step, and I was and then I'd go into the shower, and once I got the hot water in me, I used to come out like Superman. And I'm ready for the day, and I'd go training, you know. But this was a routine, and she used to go, Liz, please retire. And I was going, okay. And then Sam persuaded me to play for another year.
You know, what comes through is your pure love of the game, and you went in on your terms, you came out on your terms playing, and you went out with a smile on your face. And now, of course, where you've gone from coaching, and now at Queen's Park Rangers, where virtually it all began.
Mm-hmm.
And to finish with director of football, and how is life there at Queen's Park Rangers, and how are you enjoying being on the other side of the fence now?
Yeah, the other side of the fence is good second best, you know, because I sit in the stand and I kick every ball, I make every save, I've become one of the punters, I make every save, I score every chance, I make every pass, but I know how tough it is for the boys down there. And you know, going back to QPR and them giving me this opportunity, I did all my coaching badges and my pro licence and everything else, but I didn't think I'd get a job as a manager. So I had to look at other avenues, and this was an avenue that I looked at, and I was fortunate to get the opportunity to do it at QPR. But it's been enjoyable as well.
I was going to say, it's different work, it's tough work, but you love it next time.
Yeah, always will.
Les, it's been an honour and a pleasure. I've enjoyed every minute of it. Thanks for coming.
Paul, thanks for having me on.
My Sporting Life with Les Ferdinand on Talk Sport.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.